time to listen to the interviews from Island Life, our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. Island Life is brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 to 12 by the Village Butchers. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Oniroa. On Saturday, the 10th of September, Emma Bowell-Warner replayed an interview from a couple of years ago with Basil Holmes. She also talked to Millie Watkins about Low Impact Week and Linda Savage about the Blow the Whistle anti-domestic violence campaign.
I'm going to be replaying an interview, so slightly different format from the usual for Island Life, due to the fact that a well-known person on Waiheke sadly passed away this week. The wonderful, the strong, the opinionated, the defender of civil justice person, Basil Holmes. Now, he was a much-loved person amongst the island, and when he was interviewed, he actually was asked how long he'd been on the island, and he said it's too long to remember. And I certainly noticed him. I've only been on the island just under 6 years now, and I've certainly come across him at numerous public meetings. And he came along to when I was involved with the Artworks Theatre Trust, he came along to various things there and was always supportive and very, very passionate man that had a lot of manner about him. I didn't know him well, but I knew him well enough to say hello to and to listen when he spoke. Anyway, as I said, he's passed away this week, and so we're replaying an interview that we did on Waiheke Radio with him a while ago. But before we launch into that, just got a couple of announcements that I've been asked to speak about for friends of his. And the first is, or from friends of his, is that Basil has a lovely cat called Champ, and we need to find a new home for him. He's a mature male of 8 years old, and he's a sandy sort of champagne colour and very friendly. And he was originally rescued from the SPCA, so obviously if we can avoid it, we don't want him to go back there. So he really needs a home. So if you're thinking that you might be able to offer a home to this cat or know of somebody that may, then call Lynn, that's Lynn Stewart, on 8514. So that's if you're interested in taking this cat under your wing, call Lynn on 8514. Now, the other announcement I'd like to make on this matter is that apparently Basil would have been really against all of the attention and against a big memorial. However, a lot of people are wishing to come together to talk about and celebrate his life and to have a sharing of times and experiences. So again, Lynn and some other people are organising a gathering. So it is a gathering for Basil, and that's going to be next Saturday afternoon. That's the 17th of September. The venue, the hall, has yet to be confirmed, where you can pop along and share stories and have a cup of tea. But it will be in the Gulf News this week. And again, if you're unsure, then call Lynn on 8514 and she'll be happy to tell you where it is. But it will be in the local papers, and so you will be able to find it then. But it's definitely next Saturday afternoon, the 17th. Okay, so I'm going to replay this wonderful interview.
Hi, this is Shireen, and you're listening to Vocal Local. Today I'm talking to Basil Holmes, who's been on the island for a long time. Oh. How long have you been here, Basil?
I've forgotten.
Right. And knows a lot about the island history and has lots of opinions and has been an active campaigner on many different kinds of campaigns. So welcome to the show.
Thank you, Shireen. But my thoughts and interests are far beyond the confines of the island. Much as I love the island, and the island is an interesting place because it's a microscopic version of lots of things that's going on, so you meet all sorts of people. And it's not all gloomy here, it's not always sunshine. But my general interests, I have to say, have been over my rather long life, I mean, much broader than the interests of Waiheke Island.
What are the major challenges you think we're up against?
Well, you can't talk about the challenges of the present without thinking about the reality of the past, you see. And one of them, I do have some gristles, which is the privilege of an elderly gentleman, and or even a grumpy gentleman that I am lots of times. And this is to do with, for example, just to take one case, the lack of knowledge of our country's history. And this is sort of too formal. You can learn a formal history, you know, Treaty of Waitangi, 1840, you know, World War One, etc., etc. But there's also a deeper history, a history, for example, how many modern people driving around on roads anywhere in this country realise up until, you know, a little while ago, in most of the country, the roads had been on foundations built with picks and with shovels. Excuse me. But the main trunk railway, if anyone uses that, was freight, as these days, was built with sheer hard work. And it rivals anything that the American Hollywood people put on about their great big railway epic things. We have our epic history too. And it's this lack of knowledge of how New Zealanders arrived, whether it's good, bad or indifferent, that I find quite shocking. And I'm not in a position to know where the full responsibility is. But then at the same time, there is a cohesion here, because within the last 25 years, it's been the cultivating of individualism and self-centeredness. And this is not an accident. And when it first was sort of promoted, most of us wouldn't have believed the situation we're now in. What I'm referring to is, for example, there was a move personified, but not quite, it was a fairly narrow sort of picture, of a chap called Roger Douglas. He was Minister of Finance, and he brought in, under a Labour government, a system which, of course, is rampant capitalism, you know. That was, in other words, the market will decide everything. And what we've got at the present time is an acceptance of things which didn't exist then. That is self-absorption, self-centeredness, me, 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 this sort of thing, which we all are, we all always have that attitude. But there was a time, and it wasn't confined to New Zealand, but there was a time in this little country where such attitudes were frowned upon. And if you're in a group of people and one person started to display suddenly, accidentally, that sort of attitude, there'd be all sorts of sardonic remarks made to bring the person back into line. That's how it was. Now, nobody notices when the main conversation at coffee tables around in local coffee shops, whether it's here or in Timbuktu, wherever the hell that is about themselves. Often a very boring subject, like I tend to be at this point, talking about the past. But my point here is that the neglect of New Zealand history, the lack of interest in it, and it's not a buried way really, because there's heaps of material available and heaps of people to talk about these things. Actually, if you scratch the surface, they'll talk about it. But often I'm shocked to find that a lot of young people now, through Hollywood, think they know more about American history and stuff like that than they do about the history of their own, where they happen to live here. And we do have a very exciting, a very interesting, and a totally absorbing history, even though it's very short. And that's why it's important. Because our history is compared with France, our culture, our local sort of incipient culture, whether it's Maori or Pākehā, although it doesn't have the strength of, say, the French or the Germans and so forth, it certainly needs to be preserved. Because if people do not know their own history, they will not be able to learn. And we're entering, in my own opinion, a long period of crises. I know every day we pick up the paper, the housing crisis is over and all that sort of stuff. I don't share that sort of thing. But there will be ups and downs sometimes.
I mean, for me, I think one of the issues around history and culture is a lot of kids now tend to look for things that are visual. And one of the issues is that the archives are all held in a way that it's really difficult for the public to access them, and it's really difficult for filmmakers to make films using the archives because you have to pay so much money to be able to access them. So it seems really unfair. So all this history is there, but we can't access it.
That's right.
And yes, it's written down in places as well, but it's a shame that we can't see the visual.
Well, this is the point. The Top Twin film, which sounds like I'm introducing light entertainment, and making it, because I have nothing but contempt for the cult of celebrity, not insulting various celebrities, but as a concept, is also new. We didn't have celebrities like that. We used to have All Blacks, or real All Blacks, and so forth, you know, and chaps who'd go to battlefields in the real war, and they became fairly celebrated. But it's terrible. But in the Tom Twin film, they have two segments, one about the involving the two or three things. One was the Bastion Point, another was the struggle against the nuclear ships, which Waiheke, by the way, in those days played a tremendous part, and also the struggle about the Springbok tour, which also Waihekeans played a huge part. That was in 1981. All those, we call them struggles or campaigns, each one of them took about 30 years. And but the little snippets on the Top Twin film was very good, because people who didn't know that ever happened here, those things. And my point here is that was normal, because we used to have a custom which evolved from way, way back, right back, from the very first the New Zealand Company went to Wellington. And there was a chap there called Samuel Parnell, who decided he would have an eight-hour day. He was a Chartist from England. He brought a progressive view from the English working class here to New Zealand one day on Botany Beach in 1840. A heroic man, actually, in the context. And that was a point of debate then, and it's never stopped. It never stopped when the land wars was on. But this is a country that's had, known 30 years of actual armed conflict on its soil. People don't know that. And that was between over the land wars with the indigenous people versus the new colonialism that came in, you know. Excuse me. It's this, my point isn't a sort of that everyone has to go around with an MA and simple-minded history. What my point is that the things when I was young, my elders, not my personal elders, but older people that you'd work with, building jobs and places like that, they knew this. They knew these things because it was part of their family existence. It was part of their family existence. I had to spend 18 months in a high school in Taranaki, and my schoolmates were hopping on our bicycles in those days. Because I became fascinated, coming from Palmerston North, where nothing ever seemed to happen then. And every hill in South Taranaki had seen a bit of a battle, either pre-European or post-European. That was a great big war zone, you know, a long time ago. And these schoolboys, 13 and 14 and 15 years of age, knew the sort of history of each of them. They were Pākehā. They knew the history of these little forts and fortresses, and they could explain all these things. They didn't think they were very clever. The reason they knew these things was they were part of the family history. And I suspect that what really happened was that Granddad had been part of the people trying to bump the Maori off the land to get the thing, you see. But they knew this history, and that was nothing very special about that. Every country district, the people would know their own history, not history of war or anything like that. But it was this, and the question of the sacrifices people used to make. Hard work, hard physical labour to create something here. It wasn't put on the plate for them, you see.
And I thought it was quite interesting.
So this was what I mean by, this is being chopped off, and it's shocking.
Yeah, I thought it was quite interesting seeing the film that your brother made, Fighting Back, about the carpenters' strike in 49.
Yeah, it was a lockout, actually.
49. Yeah. When, sorry? A lockout.
Yeah. In 49, yeah.
I didn't realise it was a lockout. But what I thought was quite interesting is when I looked at the people acting in the film who were the carpenters, when I looked at the way they were dressed, you know, they all had holes in their jumpers, and they looked really poor in a way that I I don't see people looking quite so poor now.
Ah, but they were carpenters. They weren't poor, and then they're far from it.
Right.
And they would have been horrified to think they were, because their idea of poverty was a few years before, during the Depression. And what you were looking at were chaps who'd been through the war, come back, and they probably lived in very good quality houses. In fact, they all would have, because they would have built them themselves. This was by 49, this was well underway, post-war, you see. No, they weren't poor.
So the reason I ask is because I
That's what they used to wear, their old clothes, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a shortage of, in those days, worldwide, there was a shortage of everything. We weren't short of food, we used to send it up to England. But there was a shortage of material for clothing, because the war thing went on.
So clothing was quite expensive.
Yeah, but also there was not much material available, you see, because in Britain, for example, they were still rationing food. We didn't have that here. This was years after the war stopped.
Yeah, my mum went to, she studied in France in the 50s,
yes.
And she's Indian, and she arrived in Paris with all her silk saris.
Yes.
And she said it was incredible, because in 56 in France, people were still living in a way that was quite simple and didn't have access to a lot of things. And she was coming with all this Indian finery.
I thought she was going
so
to Paris.
Yeah,
flash Paris. When we talk about relative standards, of course the standard living, in those days, very few people had their own motor car. At the time, you're talking about 1949. And, carpenters would bicycle to work. Naturally, they look fit when you saw them on the film.
They did. They all looked incredibly,
right.
No one seemed overweight or big and burly or...
No. That's right. Well,
they must
that's
have all
why.
Been very popular with the girls.
I don't know. These chaps are mostly happily married men. Yes, well, that's right. That's how they were, and that was taken for granted. And they weren't poverty-stricken, and they weren't... If you look at photographs taken 20 years before, then in 49... 15 years before, and you see the faces of the people then. They were gaunt, unemployed, you see, and they were short of food. Now, they really were poor. But the people you saw in the film had been a war, and they'd come back, and they were full of fight. They weren't going to accept second-rate life. So the question of getting plenty of housing was a big issue. But no one made a big issue about getting plenty of motor cars. It wasn't, and there were several reasons for that. One was that it seemed to be unimportant. It was good if you could do it; that'd be good. That's something for the future. Secondly, the only way you got a new car in those days was you had to have what they call overseas funds. It was very sort of complicated. And so very few...
What do you mean by overseas funds?
Well, if somebody had an auntie in England who had a lot of money, that would be... the New Zealand government say, good, we'll let you buy a motor car because you'll use that hard currency, you see, if you could follow that. New Zealand currency held no value.
Ah, right, so it was like a government getting money into the country.
Yeah. They wanted what they call hard currency, which was, odd as may seem now, as British sterling.
Yeah, we'll be back soon. We're talking to Basil Holmes, and you're listening to Vocal Local.
The other point that I think about, is the state of leadership in New Zealand at the present time. Now, we go back to these great big public debates that used to take place up until the 1980s, and I wish some essayists, some scholars, would start to really deal with this issue of the transformation and the dumbing down of the country, you see. Because in those days, whichever side it was, there was a sort of a leadership would emerge from whichever side it was, whether it was right, left, or anything, you see. These days, there's no left-wing movement, so it doesn't matter. But we don't have any inspirational leadership whatsoever in any single department of life. And I know that's a bit tough to say to some good people in Waiheke who are struggling like mad to do important things. But what I'm talking about is not a reflection on the people who get out and do things, but it's a reflection on the lack of vision, the lack of looking at the overall picture, where things will be in 20 years, 50 years or 60 years. And I'm not talking about the super city, because that could be turned into the most unstable thing in a few years' time. I think possibly they're inventing something which is so unnatural.
Why do you think it's unnatural?
Because there's, there's going to be, it'll have to be a huge bureaucracy. And the people at some stage will not be getting what they need, because municipalities in this country get away with anything so long as no one notices that they're there. So you pay your rates and some mysterious people come along and fix the footpaths. This is not new. This is an old New Zealand custom of totally ignoring local bodies unless at certain points you get into it. But I think what's going to happen when the super city goes on, it'll have certain powerful abnormalities. Even at this stage when we talk about greed and avarice, there are certain people who are already shooting their mouths off in anticipation of making an awful lot of money. First of all, setting up, making money out of the new organisation, you know, building roads and footpaths and things like that. And the other one is that other people have got other interests, are looking forward to the sale of these enterprises, which normally and traditionally were New Zealand municipal things, say the water to the French, you know, something else to the Chinese, or something. Soon there'll be nothing left. I think this is going to bring a reward which the architects of this scheme are not anticipating, because that's part of what I'm trying to say.
Do you think it's not anticipating or feel indifferent to? Because, I mean, surely there's enough in our history to tell us that selling off water and privatising, utilities,
yes,
isn't a really good idea, and the state often ends up buying them back at much more expensively and in a state of disrepair.
Until they sell it the next time.
Mm.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Well, I don't think it works quite like on the basis of decent logic. If it was dealing with human beings, you know. But there is a program, you see, because they do believe, or they practice this idea that the market decides everything, so the bigger the market, the bigger the thing. I'm just looking at the news, the New York Times, on my computer every few minutes sends me little one-line things. And the current one, as we talk, is the Bank of America, which is much bigger than New Zealand. It's going to be a huge amount of billions short of money, because they haven't, and the government's worked it out, and the banking crisis, which arose from greed and avarice, these old-fashioned terms, it really did, because the people who talk about it, not New Zealand, but in Britain and New York, about the banking crisis, they talk about this. And this means, you see, that we have a situation now where it's not just the banking system, but the whole of our economy now is being based upon this market forces thing. At this very time, this is what comes back to how we should be looking ahead, of this is an economic crisis. There's every possibility of some point or other of a pandemic, even if it's not this one. They talk seriously that always will be one, which sounds a bit gloomy. But you'll find that's crises after crises in different fields now. And because of that, you would expect, if there was a leadership, a real leadership, I'm not talking about speech writers writing rhetoric for good actors like the President of the United States, he can really turn it on. I'm not talking about that. But inspirational leadership comes from the experiences of the people reflected through certain individuals at the top. That is what it's about. Leadership is not being bossy. What we have now is bossy people, actually. And it's this is what I mean. And if we had, and I think, if what I think is true, we're living in a sort of a, what I call a decadent, historically speaking. I mean, it's got nothing to do with people going around getting drunk on Fridays. That's another form. But I'm talking about how history rises to great heights, you know, the Renaissance or something like that, or the post-French revolutionary period. and then you have low periods. And I think we're in a low period, and it'll lead to an enormous transformation of the society, whether we like it or not, it'll happen. Alternatively, it could lead to the collapse of the present capitalist order, and after the chaos of that, something will emerge. And then also the leadership will come from people who say this is not enough. And they won't be slightest bit interested in celebrities. They won't be the slightest bit interested in the consumer society and these other things that have turned up at the present time. We talk about the super city. They seriously discuss in the Herald which celebrity could become the super mayor, who's going to have more power than the Prime Minister in New Zealand.
Yeah, it's quite astonishing.
It's quite appalling. And this is why there should be a public debate.
Mm.
And there are some people taking to the streets on this issue.
That's right. On the 25th of May, there's a big demonstration. Have you seen that?
Yes, well, someone told me.
Yeah.
See, I'm out of touch.
Right.
Yeah, well, this is good, you see.
But I think it's a bit lame if that's the only way we have of protesting a super city is to take to the streets on a particular day and time. But anyway.
Oh, yeah, well, that's how things start.
Mm.
That's part of our history. They start off like that. And they carry on like that. And then it becomes ugly.
Mm.
And then there's change. But I think that what we're talking about is not just the immediate campaigns. And you said, or you asked me at some stage, why do I campaign? Because I have, I suppose, since I've been about 15, doing certain things like this. And I'll have to say this, that if we could bring back all my contemporaries from their graves, they would be puzzled at such a question, because it was normal to worry about your community, to worry about your country, to worry about this, that, and the other. That's why they went to wars, World War II. Now, people did campaign on a little issue, whether it was getting a telephone box at the corner, they used to have those in those days, or something massive and big. It was that sort of society. And in the course of that, people would have these big debates, you see. And as I say, the word debate is not to be confused with a gentlemanly debate in the local school hall. You know, a fun thing. This would be people taking all forms of discussion, and often it would be quite unpleasant physically. A lot of people arrested at certain stages. And then it reaches a new level of achievement. And I think this is all going down the gate.
Where did people debate? Where did they talk? How did they talk?
They just talked everywhere. I would get into awful trouble on building jobs. I don't know if you've met many building workers, but they can be sort of rough. But they're straightforward. Well, they used to be in my time. Anyway. And if I said something that was a bit beyond what they thought was correct, they'd let me know. I've had people throw stones at me on a job. And all that.
So when did they throw stones at you? What did you say?
Oh, that was over the Springbok thing. Some people... It's hard to sort of realise... Leather Top Twins has a hint of it there on that film. The animosity between the two sides on that issue. Because rugby in those days... I don't think it's true now, but rugby in those days was very basic to the New Zealand culture. Sounds silly, but it was true. It comes from the colonial days. It was one thing our people did well. And it's no longer true, you see, as you probably work out. But because of that deep respect, affection, and the fact that a rugby club in many, many towns was the centre, the social centre was the local rugby club. Not just play rugby, that's where it was. The taller things in any church was goalposts. Yeah, it was how it was, you see. So naturally, when people say, well, we shouldn't play rugby with our traditional rugby foes, the South Africans, you just don't say that and walk away back home smoothly. It built all sorts of animosity because it was challenging. But curiously, ultimately, and this is the point that where you learn from history, that the people who were the minority and offside on that sort of principled issue at the beginning, and this is going right back to 1960 or 19 earlier than that, it was the people who are opposed to supporting the Springbok thingies, they won. And it wasn't a sort of physical winning one day, but often thanks to the way the other side carried on, ultimately New Zealand, it was a terrible time. It was a terrible time. And had it gone on another week, this particular period of this, people would have been killed in this country, on our streets.
Unfortunately, well, some people were permanently damaged.
Some people were permanently damaged, yes. But the, compared with what happens on May Days in places like Turkey, it was pretty not too bad. But by our standards, it wasn't too good either. That's a public debate, New Zealand style, as it was. And the people could... They expected their neighbours to know what they were talking about. Now, we don't have that feeling now. I don't know what the neighbours know about anything now. They probably know an awful lot more than I do about lots of things. But
I mean, for me, it's also an issue around media concentration. If you actually look at the way media works now, there are basically six organisations that control the means of production and... You know, 90% of media outlets and newspapers or TV stations or radio stations around the world. So
it's
very difficult to, you know, when we're in a global culture, to then have lots of diversity of opinion. I think your opinion gets concentrated by what people see and what
they're brainwashed.
Exposed to.
Yeah, well,
I mean, even if you look on the internet, a lot of the, MSN.com news or whatever, often it has a celebrity as a possible choice. Sort of celebrity story is a possible choice that you can click on.
It's awful. It's really tragic, actually, because we're playing around with life and death.
Mm.
You see, if you get things.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, if you go to Africa, you see, you find a lot of people are dying, either from the fact that the system's buggered up their countryside. You know, they've turned meadows into deserts, and these people. One solution is for one member of the family to make a desperate trip up to Libya from somewhere and then over, and if they're lucky to get somewhere else, and then they probably get arrested and sent back. This is shocking. This is actually happening. Our media don't deal with this very much, you know. But this is actually what's happening. So it's a matter of life and death. It's a matter of life and death for Afghanistan. I don't go along with these people who see Mr. Obama as some sort of messiah. I think people think that because they want to believe, at least... It saves them doing anything. If there is a messiah, you can pull the switches. But I think they're going to discover that no matter who the president of the United States is, he's just the same as all the presidents of the United States. And he's going to put 17,000 extra troops, which is a lot of troops, into Afghanistan. Now, you don't go to Afghanistan to pat the children on the head. You go there to kill Afghanis. And whoever they call, which team they play for, it'll still be the people that will be doing their dying. And I think that we're starting to lose our sensitivity, our human, because when, for example, when the Japanese went into China, amongst other things, and it was recorded by some brave American missionaries, they actually bayoneted.
When was that, in the 1930s?
In the 1930s. Mm. The point, I'm making a point here, see. Now, communications were not good. You didn't have instant overnight TV stuff then. But one period there in a place called Chongqing, it probably happened all over there, or Nanking, I'm forgetting now. Anyway, in the city, these American missionaries photographed with movie thingy, Japanese soldiers bayoneting in the street. They tied up women and children and old men and tied them up and put them in the street, and they used them for bayonet practice instead of straw, which other people would do to learn how to use the bayonet. This was shocking. Now, the point about this news came back, and the people were horrified and shocked, you see. Now, you can read about fairly similar things happening now, and I don't find that wave of revulsion or shock. I don't think Mr. Mark Sainsbury seems to talk about those things. Everything's safe and secure and middle class, and God only knows what agony is going on in many households now. People don't seem to care these days about unemployment. Another recommended exercise is listening to Morning Report to hear economists talk. Now, I imagine they're just out of their pimply stage, but they've got a soft job with some bank or something like that, And they said, well, unemployment is probably going to keep down to 5%, but it may go up to 6%. I don't know, as if there was no humans involved. They're talking about livestock going to the abattoir or the freezing works to get slaughtered. These are people living in small New Zealand towns who do real work. They're not economists. They're not paper shufflers. They don't go to glass towers in the middle of Queen Street. They actually do something.
And I thought it was quite interesting when they were talking about a reduction to a four-day week as being a way of, you know, getting us through a recession. And, you know, the union leaders were saying you can't put people on a four-day week because they can barely afford to live on a five-day week. So, you know, they could work for 4 days, but you can't pay them less because they've already got.
That's right. That's right. There's nothing new about that. Here the point is that these chaps who go to the right barb and the right suit maker and all that sort of thing, and call themselves economists or politicians or whatever they are. We all know who they are, even if we don't know them personally. But in every household, where the husband, it's normally the male, is seen as the breadwinner, and it's still that sort of. He feels emasculated. If he hasn't got a job, if he can't come home, bring home the proverbial bacon for his wives and children, this tension goes up. Do these people care about that? Do they care about the humiliation of these people having to go along to talk to some pimply-faced person in a WINS organisation to ask for some sort of assistance? The humiliation for people who have got skills and trades and long-time service for some woolen factory or something in a small town in this country. No one talks about that. And yet we have people walking around calling themselves journalists. Mm. We'll have to change. I tell you, it's got to that point. There has to be a change. And it's not something that's going to happen from the top. Certainly not the present top at all. I don't mean the top twins. But it's got to come from down, like on Waiheke, because of a certain number of people were concerned. Over the super city, there was more people per head of population by a long way put in submissions around the super city than anywhere else in this whole Auckland region. Now, that is leadership, and that happened here.
Mm. Yeah, now, and we can be proud of that. Thank you so much, Basil, for talking to me. You've been listening to Vocal Local. This is Shireen. You can listen to this program again on Sunday at 12 or as a podcast by going to the waihikiradio.org.nz website.
We have a brilliant addition to today's schedule. We have the lovely Millie coming in, and she's going to chat about, because I just happened to kidnap her off the street, and she's coming in to talk about No Impact Week, which we were going to do in a couple of weeks, but hey, let's be spontaneous and do it today. And you've had, 3 seconds to prepare, is that right, Millie?
I think so.
3 seconds? Oh, okay, let's just check that mic is actually on. Just speak to me a little bit, Millie.
Well, No Impact Week is
coming up the week of...
Oh, no, right, let's go back to the beginning there. Thank you very much. Slight technical hitch with the buttons. As everybody knows, I am a bit of a technical whiz and can always be trusted to sort these things out very, very quickly. So, hello, Millie, and welcome to the studio.
Hello there.
So, how are you doing?
Well, I'm doing really well on this fine and sunny day.
I know. Isn't it gorgeous?
Yes. And what we're getting ready for, a collaboration of the Community Resilience Group.
Yep. Which we've talked about before on the show, haven't we?
Yes. And we've got some participation from Waiheke Resources Trust. And what we're kicking off is No Impact Week, starting mm-hmm. the 18th of September, running through till the 24th of September. And for 1 week, it's all about taking a guided journey through to what life would look like if we perhaps lightened our load on the earth.
So what does that mean exactly? You're talking about trying to live without making as big a footprint, but what does that mean?
So what it means on the ground is allowing people to step by step experience what it would be like if they perhaps changed some habits. So instead of taking a very low-key approach to simply recycling everything, which is all well and good. This gives people a chance for a week to experience what it would be like to not go shopping or to do various things like not get takeaways. So we're not
takeaways.
Yeah.
And I'm ventilating in a corner here.
And many people like you, Emma, have had that thought of what would I do. So there's an amazing movie and book that have been written and filmed about one man's project in New York City to live for a year without with trying to make his impact
neutral.
So trying to bring it down to zero.
Wow.
So, for example, they lived in an apartment, and he did not use the elevator. And gradually, over the period of a year, he step by step weaned himself off many of the conveniences. He wanted to see if he could do it living in a city, which would be the hardest place to do something like that. And so they experienced New York City without air conditioning and, you know, no washing machine and, you know, various things. He went all out and he made a very engaging movie. Since then, he has continued with the project, the No Impact Project, and what they provide is just a one-week introductory experience for an everyday person to just take a week out of their life. And they have a program that you follow. So in other words, our No Impact Week will start out with a meeting on Saturday, the 17th of September at the Waiheke Resource Trust. And I believe it's at noon.
Right, okay.
But I can update the timing of it, but it is on the 17th afternoon.
And that's next Saturday, isn't it?
Is that already the 17th?
It is next Saturday.
Wow.
I'm moving house, so I know that date.
Oh, yes. Wow. Mm-hmm. So I'm torn. Either I can...
No,
I'll take time out to help you move house, and then we'll go to the meeting at noon.
That wasn't a hint. Don't worry.
So on that Saturday, we will be just meeting to kind of give a heads up for the week, and we will go over the program and so that everyone understands what they're doing. So in other words, on Sunday, they start out with the easiest thing on a Sunday is to not shop for the week. Now, we're not talking about shopping for things you need. We're talking about recreational shopping.
Right.
So we're going to avoid the malls for a week. And so we start with that on Sunday. It's kind of an easy one as a segue in. And then progressively we go through and give up something each day. And at the same time, we're keeping kind of a log.
Right.
So that you can just kind of reflect how it feels to do without this or that item. Now, you will not be shopping for the entire week. You have kicked off on Sunday something that you will, that won't just end on Monday. So, in other words, we're going to incrementally build throughout the week.
Got you.
Just trying to let go of one thing and then the next. And then by the end of the week, we will be at a place where the impact is greatly reduced, if not neutral or zero.
Right. Okay. So how would that work for people that have to go to work in the city?
So it is a challenge.
Do they need to take the week off?
No. So what we have to do, obviously, in our lives is whenever we take on a project like this, we have to take it to the extent that we can. Now, this man who did this project for a year did not give up living and working in New York City for a year. He had to do everything and figure out a way to make it work in his life. And not only that, his wife and his daughter. So getting their daughter to school and doing all of the things. And his wife was an editor at a magazine, so had a very high-powered kind of Starbucks-fueled life. And so she had to make adjustments and figure out how to make those trade-offs.
Sure.
So by doing this as a group, it allows us to look at what we think might be problems, and we can talk as a group. Mm. So someone going to work would say, well, you know, how am I going to tackle this? And then, so on that first meeting, we can kind of say, oh, well, you know, you might be able to do it this way or that way. So there are lots of ideas. I just want to, before I go any further, there is a formal process. This particular week is actually happening around the world. So in other words, when you do this No Impact Week starting the 18th, you're actually doing it along with people from France and Italy and the US and the UK.
Okay. Right. So it's an international
week
rather, not day. Yeah.
There are groups around the world And so these groups, they have some open groups that you could just sign on to, but they tend to be regional. And there is a group for Waiheke. So it's Waiheke Community Resilience is the group. So there are some open groups. Ours is a closed group because we're a small island and we're...
So how do people, if people are interested, how do they get more information?
So that's a tricky one. That's the one thing I wasn't prepared for. I would have had the. There is a website,
right?
The No Impact Project.
Okay, the No Impact Project.
And so, what I would suggest is simply to Google the No Impact Project,
okay, right?
And then from that point, you will get. It's the Yes Magazine. Is sponsoring this particular No Impact Week.
Right.
So there's I'm throwing out a lot of information.
Yeah, but if people are interested, then they can Google No Impact Week and they can find out some more about it.
Yes.
And there's a group happening on Saturday of next week.
Right, so if you just wanted to show up on that day. So many people have already registered for Waiheke's No Impact Week. And so anyone who wants to do can go along and... just show up and see if they're interested in registering. And when you register, you get a program for the week that has a lot of information. And this is all done online because one of the things we can do is avoid paper.
Mm.
And so you can just download a PDF document that has all of the materials that really, tell the whole story. And flesh out a lot of these details.
And are there further meetings throughout the week, or is there support for people that think, well, I might like to give it a go, but I'm not quite sure how I'd make that work for
right.
me?
Right. So what we're planning to do is we're planning to do a bookend at the very least. So we're going to do a meeting on Saturday before we get started on Sunday so that people can kind of get in the mood and get their heads around it. Then we want to do a wrap-up at the end. So that on that Sunday, we'll be meeting again at the Waste Resource Trust. And I think, I'm trying to remember, I think it was in the afternoon. But we can update that information.
Of course.
And so then on Sunday afternoon, we'll be talking to wrap up the experience. And people can just share what
worked for them and what didn't and where they struggled and perhaps share some tidbits of information because that's what it's about, I would imagine, isn't it? Sharing that knowledge.
Yeah, and insights into, what happened. How did you feel about giving up this particular item? Often it's, it was really hard to give it up, but then I found something of value in it once I had actually given it up. And I think it's a nice, it's kind of like a stress test for our lives because we go along and we take for granted a lot of the things that we have until there's a power shortage and all of a sudden we have to scramble. So these kinds of experiences where we voluntarily give up a series of items and get to experience, if I don't have this in my life, nothing works. So what can I do to make myself more resilient? Mm. And so that's the aspect where Waiheke Community Resilience comes in, where people can voluntarily give themselves a little test, see where their weak spots are, and say, we actually don't have, this particular item that we would need.
Absolutely, absolutely. I was just reminded then of being a Catholic, and actually I'm not a practicing Catholic, but I was brought up a Catholic, and of Lent and of that, that having to give something up. There's like synergies there of you give up something that you're really actually going to miss, and I suppose it's got some similarities there. But what about I'm really quite interested in this book and film you were talking about. So what if somebody can't, for whatever reason, they can't partake in the week coming up, but they're actually interested in finding out a bit more about how it works? Because that sounds really interesting to me.
The book and the movie, I believe, are both called No Impact Man.
No Impact Man, right.
Kind of like an anthropological thing. And the person's name is Colin Bevan, BEAVEN.
Right.
So,
okay. But if you Google No Impact Man, I'm sure Waiheke Library will be able to get hold of it.
Absolutely.
For you. Okay. Well, thanks very much, Millie. That sounds really interesting.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Thank you for allowing me to kidnap you and the puppy.
Waiheke Radio.
Oh, well, hello there. And we're back now with I've got a Gavis gone in my mouth. Back with Linda Savage from Living Without Violence. Hi, Linda. How are you doing?
Hi, Emma. Nice to see you.
You just need to pull the microphone a bit closer to you. Just pull it to you. That's great. So how are you doing on this beautiful Saturday morning?
Doing wonderful. Beautiful weather, isn't it?
So what about you last night then? Where were you?
I was at home with Darby.
With Darby?
No, not with Darby, actually. Oh, my God. No, Darby was with his wife. I was at home with Joan.
Right, yes.
Watching the opening ceremony. And like you, I was incredibly proud to be an adopted New Zealander.
Mm.
I thought they did fantastic. I think the sadness is that they underestimated the crowds.
Mm.
You know, that's because it was amazing, world class.
It was world class, absolutely. So, anyway, we're not here to talk about that because, God, we've spent enough time this morning talking about that little itty bitty little thing that's going on, that sports thing, the football World Cup. Oh no, is it football? No, it's rugby. Anyway, whatever. Moving swiftly on.
Well, kind of, Emma. We're still in the whole sporting arena, I'm afraid.
Oh. Yes. Oh, okay. Go on then, if you must.
Okay. I'm here to talk about Blow the Whistle campaign.
Blow
the Whistle 2011.
Okay, so what is that? Enough joking. I've done enough teasing now. This is serious matters. Go on.
Okay, right. Blow the Whistle campaign is a campaign that... it's an innovative campaign that started up to bring together sporting organisations, family violence organisations, to target all of the sporting groups around the country. And what the idea is to blow the whistle on family violence. And so they've developed some wonderful coasters, which I know that your lovely listeners can't see them, but I can show you these posters. Gorgeous, lovely posters using terminology that they use in the sporting arena, like good hands, which obviously you need to be a good rugby player.
Do you?
And even a netball player.
Oh, yes, yes.
And a basketball player, hey. The tight five. Like you, probably, I have no idea where that comes from, but I understand it's a sporting expression.
Is it?
Yes. Okay. After-match function, I do understand.
Yes, I get that one too.
So they've got that one. And last but not least, game of two halves.
Oh, yes, I've heard that expression. Yes.
Now, on the back of these posters, we've got the blow the whistle on violence, and it gives you the violence helpline number.
So this is a campaign that Living Without Violence are doing, is it?
It's a campaign that Living Without Violence are taking part in. It's a national campaign that's going regional, local. It's from Invercargill right the way down to... at Whangarei, you know,
right.
it's huge. It's right the way through the country. So there's many, many people getting involved. Now, what we've decided to do is to work with the 22 teams that Darby and Joan are working with on the Rugby World Cup 2011. Sorry, right. I know I mentioned it, but there you go.
It's okay. It's okay.
So what we've done is we've gone round to some of them. We're still yet to finish them. And spoken to them about using these coasters, putting up the banner at putting up the posters and putting out the coasters. It's a little bit of a tongue twister. And then we've given them some whistles, and so during the matches, when they play the matches, people can blow the whistles. They're great little whistles, and they've got wonderful land guards on them, which again talk about blow the whistle and give you the blow the whistle helpline number that people can call if they're concerned about family violence.
So it's basically asking people to not just stand by and do nothing, isn't it, really?
It is. And also it's Living Without Violence and Piritahi Hawara. It's a joint initiative that we're both taking a part in.
Here on Waiheke.
And you're quite right. It's saying to people, you know, don't stand back necessarily. Help if you can. Or if you're concerned, you've got a number to ring. Now, what research has shown that during big sporting events, if your team loses, what we see is a definite increase in family violence.
Right. Okay.
Now, on the other side of the coin, even when your team wins, people tend to go to the after-match events and they drink lots and lots of alcohol to celebrate the win.
Mm.
And as you may know, and a lot of people may know, there's a direct link between alcohol consumption and family violence.
Yeah.
So even winning isn't necessarily leaving some people in a safe position. So the research is, there's a lot of research been done on this, and so that's why they wanted to set up this Blow the Whistle campaign, actually go directly to the different sporting groups across the country. Mm. And what a fantastic time to start it at the Rugby World Cup.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
You know, it's a brilliant start.
So what kind of response has the campaign had from sporting groups?
Great. There's been some major sporting personalities coming out and speaking on radio and on television supporting the campaign. There is a national campaign that's launched. It should have been launched. It should be on TV in the next few days, really, so I've been told, launching the campaign and talking about the campaign. The establishments that we've been round to have been fantastic, you know, really great, absolutely in, supportive, taking the coasters, the posters, the whistles, you know, really backing it. And that's the story that we've heard from other agencies around the country.
Right. Okay. Mm. Well, that's fantastic. So, how can people sort of, how can organisations or anything around Waiheke support you? Is there, you know, can they put the posters up for you, that kind of thing?
Yeah, if people are interested in putting up the posters, then please give us a call on 372-9220 or pop into our new office, which is...
Just about to say, of course, because you've just moved, haven't you?
Indeed, we have. We haven't... We're not up and operational per se in the office because we're having some renovations done, which we need to have done. But we are staffing the phones and checking our emails. So if you're keen to put up some of these posters, either contact us by phone, 372-9220, or contact us by email, which is lwv.waiheke@extra.co.nz. Or indeed pop into this new office. We are around at 56 Ostend Road. So it would be great. And brilliant. If you're a sporting group that we haven't contacted yet and you want some whistles, then again, get in touch with us and we will get some whistles to you.
Fantastic. Okay, well, thanks very much, Linda. I think it's a very, very worthwhile campaign and brilliant timing to kick it off.
Absolutely. Another sporting expression.
I know, I couldn't help it. through the World Cup. So well done, and I wish you all the best with it. So thanks very much for popping into the studio.
Thanks ever so much, Emma. Thank you.
Okay.
You've been listening to the interviews from Island Life, our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirawa.